Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, am I coming home? Am I coming home? Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm hoping you hear these words. Your gray stern blue, gray stern blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I care and I won't let go. Even though we're oceans away, you're
another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, joined by my co-host, Peter Fowler from Glendale, Arizona, and I am in the heart of the belly of the beast in Washington, D.C. We've got another great episode for you today. We're going to have an outstanding guest who's been on the show a couple times before, and that's none other than the editor and founder of the Pan-African Newswire, and that's Abiyomi Ezekwe. And he's also a member of the Detroit Coalition Against Brutality. And he'll be spending some time with us today, you know, discussing the recent police murder of the 7-year-old girl, Ayanna Jones. And so he's done a lot of mobilization along with his comrades in Detroit around putting pressure to make sure that those that that murdered that young girl unwarrantedly, you know, are brought to justice, and furthermore, you know, having a total end to police brutality and police murder in Detroit and beyond and throughout this nation. It's a scourge that continues to affect people of color, blacks and Latinos, at a very, very disproportionate rate in comparison to their white counterparts throughout America. And we know that police brutality and police murder, especially when it comes to its effects on communities of color, is rooted in institutional racism. It is rooted in institutional racism, and it's something that you've never heard the Democratic Party, and obviously not the Republican Party, speak anything about on their political platform in terms of eradicating institutional racism throughout the U.S. It's something that they never, ever mention. And it's just a further reminder for those of us who continue to live in this fantasized, mythological world, you know, that America is some kind of equitable society that is free of injustice, free of racism. That's definitely not the case. And we need to wake up, and we need to understand that, and we need to understand that those two corporate parties don't give a damn about eradicating institutional racism in any shape, form, or fashion. That at the very least, they wish to place a 2-inch Band-Aid on a 7 to 9 inch gash on your arm. That's the equivalent. So, anyways, we'll be speaking with Abiyomi Ezekwe, who's going to bring us up to date on a great many things, and we're joined by Peter Fowler. Peter, I don't know if you want to introduce yourself briefly, and we'll get to the news.
Yeah, Solomon, it's always good to be back on the air with you, brother. Again, this is Peter Fowler from the hyper xenophobic state of Arizona. And, you know, looking at the issues we're going to talk about today with Brother Ezekwe is certainly timely, given some of the recent developments in my home state right now, the xenophobia and the racism that is in the news because of what Arizona has done recently. And so it's always good to keep this in front of us. And like you said, the delusion that the United States, that this society is somehow progressing beyond being the racist state that it's been throughout its history is total fabrication. It's pure myth. And the brother we're going to talk to today, I think, will bring the issue to light in terms of the police brutality. And so I'm looking forward to our conversation with Brother Ezekwe. And always good to be back with you, brother.
Likewise. And those of you guys who are listening right now, if you check out the recent online edition of Daily Censored, that's www.dailycensored, that's Daily Censored, as if you're being censored from speech or something like that, dailycensored.com. You'll see Peter's recent article in Daily Censored, and definitely check it out. It has to do with the wording and nomenclature that a lot of us oftentimes place without thinking when we speak of our government or these types of things, that it's not our government. Our government is not acting on our behalf, and Peter breaks it down. Line by line. It's a great piece, so definitely check out dailycensored.com when you get a chance. So without further ado, I want to kick things off right now. I think this clip is totally apropos given the subject matter that we're going to address in this show. So I'm going to play this, and on the other end, Peter and I will join you, and if anyone wants to call in during this time, the call-in number is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191.
A full-blown police state exists in New York City. It's not the result of a crime wave. Crime has been on the decline for decades, as successive city administrations proudly boast. The New York police state has been methodically constructed by the city administration to create an environment of fear and intimidation in black and brown neighborhoods. Last year, the racist police state juggernaut swept up nearly 500,000 African American and Latino New Yorkers, while affecting only 53,000 whites. A Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuit forced the city to begin keeping racial data on police activity following the 1999 police killing of Amadou Diallo. The latest data show that blacks are 9 times as likely to be stopped and frisked as whites, and these are anything but polite police procedures. In about 1 out of 4 cases, police draw their weapons or throw people to the ground. Still, only about 6% of the stops result in a formal arrest. In other words, in 3 out of 4 cases in which cops draw their weapons or use violence against New Yorkers on the street, it involves totally innocent persons, unworthy of arrest. Police used force against only 19% of whites, but against 27% of blacks. Those whites that are among the very small proportion stopped by police are slightly more likely to be arrested than blacks, and 1.5 times more likely to be carrying a weapon. The Center for Constitutional Rights concludes, as would any sane observer, that the stop and frisk numbers reflect racial bias and that they are flagrantly unconstitutional. It is equally clear that stop and frisks have reached astronomical heights, increasing 5-fold under the current police commissioner, on direct orders of City Hall. The pace of unjustifiable stops has become too fast and furious even for some street cops. The Village Voice newspaper is publishing a series of articles based on secret police recordings of supervisors as they impose relentless and escalating quotas for stops and petty summonses on residents in black and brown Brooklyn. This has nothing to do with crime and everything to do with enforcement of a racist social order. The cops claim that they're simply exercising their right to stop people based on reasonable suspicion. But of course, white racism has its own system of reasoning, its own logic. It even invents or imagines its own facts. Police fill out forms to list the facts as they see them after every stop and frisk on the street, as required by New York City law. In nearly half the cases, cops claim they stopped a pedestrian because he was making furtive movements. What are furtive movements? Apparently, whatever the police think or imagine they are. The second biggest excuse for frisking people, listed in 30% of the stops, is that they were casing a victim or location. In other words, the cop could just look at the suspect and see that he had felonious intentions, that criminal look about him. In 19% of the cases, the cops don't even bother to be specific about why they made a person a target of the state. They simply check other as the reason. Why has New York created a police state for blacks and Latinos? Because the powers that be think that a voting majority of citizens approve, and because the black and brown leadership are in the pockets of those in power. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And please, definitely make sure that you visit blackagendareport.com every single week, every Wednesday, for their very on-point critical analysis of news domestically and abroad. And I want to start off, you know, if folks are listening, if you go to the New York Times, if you just type in Google, into Google, New York Times, and then space, stop and frisk, you'll get an article that was in the New York Times on May 13th. And, you know, it gets to a point where they mentioned the data that was collected by the Center for Constitutional Rights, where they unveiled that nearly 490,000, that's 490,000 blacks and Latinos were stopped by the police on the streets in 2009 as compared to 53,000 whites. 53,000 whites were stopped. And 490,000 blacks and Latinos were stopped. And when, and then it goes on to find out to go on, and I'll read it. But once stopped, the arrest rates were virtually the same. The whites that were arrested, the whites were arrested in slightly more than 6% of the stops, and blacks in slightly fewer than 6%. About 1.7% of whites who were stopped were found to have a weapon, while 1.1% of blacks were found to have one. So that's just damning evidence, you know, that of something vastly rotten in Denmark, in this case New York City, and also throughout the you know, throughout the nation. Peter, I don't know if you want to comment on that story.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that Glenn points out that I think is important is the political motivation that lies behind perhaps not the individual tactics and measures by the police officers on the ground, but the political motivation for the tolerance, for the toleration of the sustained type of police state measures and the sustained type of harassment and racism that goes on the ground on a day-to-day basis against black and brown skin people. And I think that's how we get into looking at how the racism is institutionalized. It's because there is a clear political motivation. It benefits the overclass, the ruling class, the white ruling class of New York City and of course, other urban areas across this country to continue to utilize those police state measures, those harassment and intimidation, and they play off of and tolerate the ignorance and the racism of the police officers on the ground. And the thing is this is not a new phenomenon. The phenomenon of racism by the police, by police officers across the country. This isn't just something that's unique to New York City or to the state of New York or to the East Coast. This is something that has been well documented across the country, across this entire nation, for decades now. I first did research and some extensive writing on this topic back in the mid '80s. So you know the research has been there for decades about the racism at the level of the police officer, where police officers are seeing black citizens as more culpable, as being suspicious, as looking like criminals. And the statistics bear out the fact that even though black and brown skin people are stopped and frisked and harassed by the police and held you know, those kind of measures, the number of arrests compared to the white counterparts are virtually the same, and so you know we see very clearly the racism on the streets, and let's not just pass it off as you know that these are white. So many of the white officers don't know how to perceive black citizens, which is the case very often, because what you have is you know you have a lot of white officers who just don't. Understand black mannerisms, black behaviors, black habits. A good example of that might be a couple of white officers in a cruiser. They come by a street corner and they see some black youths hanging around, just chilling like kids do. And they're more likely to see those black youths as being engaged in something potentially criminal than they would if they were to come across a small group of white youths. And so it's certainly just ignorance on the part of the police, but also and more importantly is the fact that there's an intimidation factor there. That kind of harassment is intentional in creating a climate of intimidation and fear in black and brown communities. So there's a whole matrix of ugly racism on the ground at the level of police officers, and then again the political motivation for the higher ups, you know the politicians and the fat cats that run the city, that works for their benefit, for their political benefit, to have this this state of police measures and the intimidation and the fear amongst the black and brown citizens. And it's truly appalling to think that in the United States that those kind of things are not only tolerated, but make for a good political career, so that they are perpetuated purposely and intentionally.
Right, and they're woven into the fabric of America, so as such that even that the data revealed that there were more whites that even though there was only 53,000 whites that were stopped and frisked compared to 490,000 blacks and Latinos that were stopped, there were more whites that actually had that were found with illegal contraband on them than their black and Latino counterparts. And so, but however, the profiling of those white, white people, whether it's in New York or pretty much anywhere in the U.S., they're not thought of as being, being suspects, the same way blacks and Latinos are. And so this goes all the way down from, in every, nook and cranny of America, the mass programming of people within America, it has to do with programming them to believe and to actually think in their realities that blacks and Latinos by nature, especially black and Latino men by nature, are violent, criminals or would-be criminals that need to be stopped, need to be frisked unwarrantedly that they can have their rights, their civil liberties abused and eschewed as if they just aren't warranted to even be given to them. This programming goes on through the media, which influence public policy. We see where blacks and Latinos are overrepresented as criminals, as perpetrators of crimes, and underrepresented as victims. Account across the board, the Center for Media Policy at Berkeley University, in California, Cal Berkeley, did a report on this a few years ago that basically showed across the board that blacks and Latinos were well overrepresented as criminals and underrepresented as victims. And this plays into how what you were just talking about, Peter, how there's this basically this complacency, among a lot of folks, to just say, it's warranted, that's where the crime exists. That's, those are the ones that are inherently, criminals. And so there's this complacency, and then there's this acceptability, we just accept it, it's going to go on. And so that's where you have, the cases where you have the Amadou Diallos, the Sean Bells, the Oscar Grants, the Adolph Grimes, the Ayanna Joneses. You have these people that are murdered by cops, where cops can just bust into somebody's house, just basically under, these friggin', Keystone cops, busting into somebody's home, because there's this air of suspicion that somebody they're looking for might be in there, and then just go in there and just start blasting, throwing in a flash grenade, and then just go in there and just busting shots. And what happens? You have a 7-year-old girl who's shot through the throat and the head and is killed. We're talking about a seven-year-old girl who should have had every right to live, her life out, to live a prosperous life, but to be gunned down and murdered, in cold blood. At age 7, is just despicable. I mean, it's despicable for somebody of any age, but somebody at 7 years of age. I mean, we can imagine what their parents must be going through, even at this time, what they will be going through for the rest of their lives, because it is something that you can never recover from. And yet, this was not mainstream news across the board. And this is what is really despicable about it, Peter, is that this is still not mainstream news. Yes, there were multiple emails and this, that, but it was not on corporate television stations, days after the incident, the same way when JonBenet Ramsey was abducted and she disappeared. I mean, that case was in the news, as we know, Peter. That case was in the news for well over a year after, years after she was missing, years after that little white girl was unfortunately abducted, you know, and went missing. Years after, it was still across the board on nitwit shows like Nancy Grace to MSNBC to Fox. I mean, across the board. But this little black girl is murdered by the cops in Detroit, and we don't. And it's almost an afterthought. It's almost an afterthought in the eyes and the realm of the corporate mainstream television airwaves. You know, just days after, nothing. So,
Not only is it less than an afterthought. I mean, it's an inconvenience for the corporate media to have to deal with a story like that. And so, it's intentionally ignored. Not just downplayed, but ignored purposefully, because it's a total inconvenience to have to air a story where our glorious police officers, actually murder a child. That's not the kind of story that perpetuates the narrative of this glorious country. The American narrative. It doesn't perpetuate that. It calls it into question, and so it's going to be ignored. And particularly, the higher ups in corporate media, they have the same perspective on the life of a little black girl as those police officers did. Her life has very little value in the eyes of corporate America, as well as in the eyes of our militarized police state. So that's a great example of the difference between the way the corporate media handles stories with regard to two little girls, one black girl, one white girl, and the complete disparity in how those stories are covered, and how one is made into a huge story that, like you said, went on for just years. And the other is a complete non-story. And that's a decision that's an intentional decision made by corporate media. So what does that tell folks? It tells folks that, the life of little Ayanna Jones wasn't that important. It didn't warrant the kind of news coverage. It didn't warrant the kind of expensive investigations that the Ramsey case did. It sends all kinds of messages. And none of it's a mistake. It plays into the real narrative of America. That black life really has very little value. That the state can do no wrong. In this case, the police, being the actors of the state, can do no wrong. So an excellent example of the disparity of in terms of the value of the life of a little black girl versus the life of a little white girl.
Exactly, and it just goes on and on and on, and these stories seldom get any kind of mainstream coverage, and when they do, it's almost like it's a footnote. It's in 1 minute or in 1 day and gone and abandoned the next. And we saw that. I mean, if Oscar Grant or Sean Bell, if they were young white men, I guarantee you, one young white man from Suffolk County, Long Island or somewhere, or Beverly Hills or some opulent suburb, I guarantee you, or it doesn't even have to be, it could be a poor white rural community, I guarantee you this would be front page news on blast. And especially can you imagine, Peter, if it was a young white man that was murdered by a black cop? Can you imagine? This would be everywhere. I mean, they would be ready to fry this brother. You know what I'm saying? They would be ready to fry him. But on the other foot, if it's a white or black cop, you know what I'm saying, that kills a black or Latino man, nah. That, you know what I'm saying? Oh well. You know what I'm saying? This happens. And the benefit of doubt, and this is what I always hear, Peter, when I bring these things up to most people that I talk to, is that when I bring this up, in the instance of a police brutality case or a police murder case where the police have brutalized or murdered a black or brown skinned man, usually the reaction I get, Peter, is people ask, what, you know what I'm saying? Even so-called, like, good-intentioned folks will ask, not even knowing how they've been programmed. Their response, initial visceral response, Peter, will be, well, you know what I'm saying, what was he doing? Not what was the cop doing. The, you know what I'm saying? The cops get the benefit of the doubt. The brother, you know what I'm saying, the brown-skinned brother or the black brother, you know what I'm saying, he is guilty. You know what I'm saying? Guilty first. It was what was he doing?
The assumption of criminality. Exactly. And that's part of that. That's part of that. That racist worldview is the assumption of criminality on the part of black and brown skinned men, and that is just the stereotype that has been ingrained and is in fact, as you mentioned, part of the social fabric of this culture. You know, there's the assumption of guilt, the assumption of culpability on the part of black and brown skinned males, particularly.
Right, and we're starting to see this, you know, as you know, with different pieces that you know that have been written, you know, on different websites or stories that I've done and soon to be stories that you've done. You know, we will see this this continuing how vastly like racist and folks are in terms of their justification for crimes against humanity that are forged by the imperialist powers, you know what I'm saying, within the U.S., how they will routinely create excuses and justifications for anything from racist, racial profiling laws in Arizona to police brutality in Detroit. And without further ado, we actually have my comrade, a friend, I'm happy to call him a friend, Mr. Abiomi Asikwe, who was a historian, he's an activist, he's a longtime activist, a dedicated Pan-Africanist, and he's the founder and editor of the Pan-African Newswire, one of the places where I routinely, on a weekly basis, get my news and information from. And he's also a member of the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality. So he knows this issue very, very well, as does, you know, he is a longtime resident of Detroit, but knows the issue of police brutality, knows the mobilization that is going on right now in Detroit. And I just want to welcome him to the show. Brother Abiomi Asikwe, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here, and it's always a pleasure to be back on this program. It's a very high-quality broadcast, and I really enjoy being a participant.
Oh, it's our pleasure. It's our pleasure. And I just want to start off by asking you a question and to kind of hit the ground running, and we're going to delve into a lot of different things. But what is going on right now with the situation in Detroit regarding the police murder of a 7-year-old girl, Ayanna Stanley Jones? I know you and other folks were engaged in a protest recently. I know your organization, the organization that you're a part of, has been doing a lot of work. Where does it stand right now, in terms of the quest to bring these officers to justice?
Well, what the city administration is doing and the corporate media is trying to cover it up or whitewash the whole situation. They're trying to frame it to put the rising crime and interpersonal violence on the same level as the police killing of a 7-year-old girl. And there's a difference, there's a distinction, and there's a distinction to be made in regard to interpersonal violence among oppressed people and state violence against oppressed people. This is what they're trying to blur. And at the same time, they're trying to criminalize the family of young Ayanna Stanley Jones, who was a 7-year-old child that was killed in the early morning hours of May 16th in Detroit at the hands of the Detroit police. So what they're trying to do is to criminalize the family, criminalize the neighborhood in which this incident took place. They have consistently repeated that this was an accident. They initially said that the grandmother who was in the same room with the young 7-year-old child, attempted to grab the gun of this police officer, Joseph Weekly, who's a 34-year-old Caucasian officer who actually, it is reported in the media, did the shooting. The grandmother, Martella Jones, has said repeatedly that she did not reach for the gun of Officer Weekly, that the first warning they had that there was any police presence at the home was when they threw a flash grenade through the front window. And after that happened, they announced Detroit police. They kicked the front door open, and a few seconds after that, young Ayanna Stanley Jones was shot through the neck, and it also did damage to her head. She died very, very rapidly. And in the aftermath of that, the police conducted a raid that lasted for several hours on the home. They took Charles Jones, the father, drug him out of the house, had him face down for a number of hours while the police combed both the downstairs and upstairs of the home. The aunt, LaCrystal Saunders, said she was brought out of the house. She had no idea that the police were there seeking entry. She said that once they heard the window explode, they then heard Detroit police. She said she was on her way downstairs. She lives upstairs, downstairs to open the door to see what was going on. And they kicked the door in and then went upstairs. Now, they claim they were looking for her fiancé, who was at the house, as a suspect in the murder of a 17-year-old youth who was killed several days before that. So this is the type of terror that people in the city of Detroit are being subjected to as we speak. The child was then drugged. After she was shot, she was drugged out of the house. There was a trail of blood from the front door of the house all the way down the steps, the sidewalk, and leading out into the street. They then summoned the fire department, which came out and washed down a lot of the blood that was out there in, you know, on the sidewalk and in the street. But some blood still remained, and I do have photographs of the blood stains on the sidewalk. But it was a harrowing experience on the part of this family. And then they took Martella Jones, the grandmother of Ayanna Stanley Jones, into custody for 12 hours. She was interrogated, she was drug tested, and she was tested for residue, firearms residue, a paraffin test. So they attempted, you know, to criminalize her as well. But then they released her after 12 hours. Now you tell me, if she was guilty or even suspected of trying to grab a police officer's firearm, that's considered assault.
Right.
Against a law enforcement officer. There's nowhere in the world they would have released her in 12 hours with no charges. So this is the lie that's being told by the police through the corporate media to try to justify what they did in this incident. Now, they're also trying to say that the family is involved in criminal activity. We don't know that. This 34-year-old man who was arrested upstairs in the house, and what's interesting is that young Ayanna Jones was shot in the downstairs flat. It was a two-family duplex. So they even went into the wrong house and shot somebody in the wrong residence who was a relative of the person who they say is guilty. So, you know, the whole thing was a total fiasco, and it resulted in the death of a 7-year-old child. Now they're moving to try to cover up the incident. But what's really interesting also in this whole situation is that how they're attempting to say that this was an accident, that, you know, they shouldn't have had a murderer in the house, they shouldn't have grabbed for the police officer's gun, you know, they shouldn't, I guess, even exist, you know, as black people in America, because in doing that, you provoke and you bring on police repression that could result in a tragedy of this nature. But as far as I'm concerned, even if Jack the Ripper or the Boston Strangler or Son of Sam, all of them could have been in that house, it still didn't justify going into a house with over 20 police from a special unit, where their toys in the yard, where their children inside the house sleeping, and then shoot a seven-year-old baby to death. Nothing can justify that. And the police at this point and the city administration are facing a very, very critical period in their existence. The mayor has been attacked around this issue. He's been attacked even by elements in the corporate media, saying, you know, he didn't handle this situation properly. Yesterday he was forced to come out and criticize the chief of police, Warren Evans, to say that he was too aggressive, that he acted independently,
right,
and that he needed to be reined in. This is what the mayor said of his own police chief.
Mm.
So he was pretty much asking for his resignation publicly. You know, to make a statement like that is going to be very difficult for Evans to continue as the police chief. But we'll see. And even if they do throw him under the bus, the police chief, it still does not get at the systematic problem that exists not only in Detroit but with law enforcement across the country, and that's racial profiling, the militarization of police policy and police tactics. And this is all tied in with this so-called war on terrorism, the war on drugs, and the so-called crackdown on crime in this country. So that in general is what's going on here in the city of Detroit in response to this latest assault on the people.
Right, and Detroit has a long history. I was looking at your website, and I saw that, you know, from 1997 to 2004, there were 53 citizens from Detroit that were killed by the police, and that was like the highest number during that duration in the nation. And since then, I remember reading that there were some youths that were shot by the police last year in Detroit. Correct me if I'm wrong, this is something that, and we know it exists throughout America, but this is something that has become a part of the fabric of Detroit, this police brutality and police murder. Am I right?
Most definitely. It's something that's gone on for many, many decades. And even if we go back to 1967, when there was a large-scale urban rebellion in the city of Detroit that lasted several days, that brought about the intervention of the National Guard as well as the 82nd Airborne Division. The spark that lit the flames of that rebellion in 1967 was police misconduct and police brutality. And it has remained with us throughout all these years. Between 67 and 73, police community relations worsened in the city of Detroit. And in 71, they initiated a decoy police unit called STRESS, which was an acronym for Stop the Robberies, Enjoy Safe Streets. And what they did, they sent out decoys to entrap particularly young African-American males into committing what was considered criminal acts. And then they were gunned down by the police. And it was like 33 people that were killed by stress between 1971 and 1973. In fact, in 1972 and 1973, there was a group of young African-American men, small group, that actually took up arms against the police and resulted in at least five police officers being shot and one shot fatally. And then, of course, in 1973, with the mayoral race, the conditions in the city were such that if Coleman Young had not won the elections in 1973 against the then white police chief, John Nichols, it could have possibly been another more violent racial outbreak in Detroit in 1973 or 1974. Now, in 1973, Coleman Young, who was the first African-American mayor in the city of Detroit, came in, and his first act was an executive order abolishing stress, this police decoy unit. He also set out to aggressively develop a affirmative action program for the police department and for the civil service in general. And that's how a lot of African Americans and women became employed with the police department as well as the city of Detroit. So this is something that just didn't come about as a result of goodwill of the government, or even civil rights laws that were passed by the federal government during the mid-1960s. The so-called integration of city government in the city of Detroit, for use of a better term, came out of the popular struggles of the people in this area. The urban rebellions of 1967, the worker insurgency movements that took place in the plant between 1968 and 1973, the heroic struggles that took place in the communities against police brutality, against exploitation by business interests, against the racist school system that was very much in evidence in Detroit during the late 60s and early 70s. And that's how a lot of African Americans were able to get some degree of empowerment in the city of Detroit. Now, during this current phase, we have Dave Bing, who is the mayor of the city of Detroit, and his orientation is totally corporate. And he didn't even live in the city of Detroit prior to becoming mayor. He lived in one of the affluent suburbs. And he just came into Detroit to run for mayor. And we know, of course, that it's the corporate community that suggested to him that he run for mayor and backed him to run for mayor. And both the corporate dailies, the conservative Detroit News and the liberal Detroit Free Press, endorsed Dave Bing for mayor. And they also endorsed the dominant five city council members who form a bloc, a conservative bloc, against anything progressive taking place in the city of Detroit. So it's a corporate program, and it's very much an evident in many cities throughout the United States of America, like what we saw in New Orleans, for example, in the aftermath of Katrina, where the large-scale evacuation of African people from that city created the conditions where now they have a white mayor and they have a majority white city council in New Orleans. It may be difficult for them to do that in Detroit because we have over 85% African American population, at least in the short term. Now, they have plans aimed at that as well. But now, if they can get corporate agents like Dave Bing who come in, who take their orders from the Kresge Foundation, from the Skillman Foundation, and all these other right-wing private foundations and think tanks, then of course they can achieve the same objectives by having a corporate agenda, but have African Americans who are administering this corporate agenda against the interests of the working people and oppressed people here in the city of Detroit, who are the overwhelming majority of the population.
Right, right. Peter?
Brother Ezekiel, this is Peter Fowler. I know you've been on the show before, but this is my first opportunity to speak with you, so I want to say what an honor it is to be able to have this opportunity to speak with you on the air.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you made a couple of critical connections a few moments ago when you were talking, and you mentioned the militarization of the domestic police force in this country, and the connection to the wider so-called war on terror, and it seems that we're seeing a normalization, a pattern of normalization of state violence, and how this country, our society, is becoming more and more immune to violence, and how state-sponsored and state-perpetrated violence is becoming just normal. It's just normalized in this country. And there's one other piece of this of the Jones case that I'd like you to talk a little bit about in terms of the militarization and the normalization of violence. And if I understand correctly, during the raid that led to the murder of Ayanna Jones, the crew, the police were followed by a television crew. Is that right?
Most definitely. The First 48 television show, which is an A&E program, filmed the entire raid. And this is an outrage in and of itself because it shows that they were performing for the cameras.
Right.
I mean, they could have brought that young man out of that house by, you know, using a bullhorn, catching him. In fact, the La Crystal Saunders, who is the was the fiance of the 34-year-old suspect in the murder of the 17-year-old, said that there was an unmarked police car in front of the home the day before for several hours. So they could have arrested this guy when he came out of the house, or when he was going back into the house. They didn't. They chose not to do it. They could have arrested him during the day. They could have just surrounded the house and asked him to come out. They would have had to come out sooner or later. But no, they go in at 12:35 a.m. in the morning, and then they have this television crew that's filming the whole operation. So the corporate media is actually feeding this whole militarization of the police domestically and a greater militarization of U.S. foreign policy internationally. As you mentioned, the normalization in the American psyche to accept violence against people overseas and to accept violence against oppressed groups here in this country. And this is what is being promoted systematically. All you have to do is watch television, and there's dozens every year of police shows that glorify police work, that make it appear as if the police are the guardians between society and anarchy and chaos, and to make it appear as if without the police or without aggressive police activity, that the American society would turn into just a free-for-all. So it's a whole brainwashing campaign that they have going. Now, the mayor yesterday in his press conference said that he wasn't aware that the first 48 crew was in Detroit and filming police operations. And that's very difficult to believe. But a contract was signed with this group, apparently, prior to the mayor even getting in office. Now, if he wasn't aware that there was a contract going on and that there was a national television program that was filming police actions here in the city of Detroit, then he needs to question his own competence as the leader of this city. And he said he's banned this show from being in the city and doing what they're doing. And also it came out in the media as well today that Chief Warren Evans was subject of a pilot program called The Chief, which was going to be another reality show in which he was going to be the principal featured personality in the TV show. And they said they had a promotional video that had the chief standing in front of 1300 Bodian with a rifle. So they're glorifying the police. They're glorifying the militarization of the police and police tactics. And this is coming from the highest levels, not only of the U.S. government, but also the corporate community in this country. And, yes, any anti-war voice, any anti-repression, anti-racist voice is needed in the corporate media. All the experts, so-called experts, all the voices, all the analysts in relationship to the war in Afghanistan, in Iraq, or anywhere else that the United States is involved, all support the war. You have people from the Pentagon. You have former Pentagon officials. You have people from the intelligence community and former intelligence communities. You have people from these right-wing think tanks and research centers that are funded by the intelligence community and by the military. These are the only people that are promoted to speak on U.S. foreign policy. And the same thing in regard to domestic policy. They do not want any voices that are clearly pointing out this over-militarization of the police and also how this increased repression ties in with the economic crisis. In Detroit, we have the largest unemployment rate in the country. We have a high degree of homelessness, home foreclosures, utility shutoffs, you know, just social violence against the people. And rather than looking at this as a source of crime and other social ills in the community, they want to blame the victims and say that the major problem is that we don't have enough police on the street, we don't have enough guns, we don't have enough chemicals, we don't have enough prisons or jail cells or repressive apparatus to control people, as opposed to taking care of people and ensure them that that they have a decent life, you know, here in this country. So yeah, it's all related: the economic crisis, political repression, as well as U.S. Foreign policy overseas.
Yeah, you've made some crucial connections, particularly to the other elements of social violence, and it seems like Detroit, unfortunately, is a laboratory for the escalation of social violence. You mentioned a lot of the utility cutoffs that have occurred there over this past winter, and we've had a conversation just on this show with regard to the public education system in Detroit and how that's being dismantled and so forth. But one connection I'd like to get your take on with regard to the normalization of state violence. And when we talk about, and it almost seems ludicrous to even have this as part of the conversation, when we talk about the corporate role of the particular crime in the Ayanna Jones case and in crime in general. But we are. We're actually talking about the corporate role in that particular crime and in the larger context of crime, particularly with the television crew that was involved there. They, as you mentioned, they'd signed a contract with the city of Detroit to actually film some of these things. So what it looks like, Brother Zeke, is a commodification,
yeah,
of state violence, a commodification of this police state, and that seems to me like it's a pretty frightening thing that we're commodifying for consumption on television the murder of human beings, you know, and what does that say about the social construct in Detroit, that you know that this is seen as entertainment by and large. It's packaged for television, and that, in fact, the way that the Detroit police staged that raid may have been and probably was influenced by the fact that they were being followed by a television crew. What are we seeing in society when we have a commodification of violence like this?
Well, I think it demonstrates, and, I like the way you categorize it as a commodification of violence and repressive military police activity, but it's just part and parcel of the whole profit-making system in this country, which is becoming more and more macabre, more and more grotesque, that they would actually commodify police operations to the extent that it would influence the behavior of the police in carrying out and exercising a warrant where there are children involved and where people were injured and even killed. So the mayor yesterday said in his press conference that he's even looked at the video that was shot by the First 48 himself. The lawyer, Jeffrey Feiger, for the family, is also saying he's seen the video. So I think it's just a matter of time before it actually gets out to the general public,
mm-hmm.
And more people will see it. But
right.
It ties right into what we were talking about earlier, and that is the glorification of the police, the acceptance of this type of violence against people, and even to influence the masses themselves to accept this, to accept the ruling class view that if there was not a murderer in the house, then this raid would have never had to take place, and that if we didn't have all these criminals in the African-American community, then the police would not have to use such aggressive actions against the people. But they never say anything about the economic crisis, the exploitation and oppression is leveled against African-American people every day,
right.
Not only in the city of Detroit, but throughout the country. That is never discussed. It's never looked at as the root cause of the problems that exist in the African-American community, because they actually benefit from crime. The ruling class benefits from crimes that are committed among the people and by the people in the African-American community. They benefit from black-on-black violence through the media. They benefit by having excessive militarization of the police. In the city of Detroit, it is the police that constitute 42% expenditures of the overall city budget. It's the police who, even last week, in the aftermath of the murder of Ayanna Stanley Jones, the Detroit City Council, this group of five that I mentioned earlier that dominates the city council, voted to allow the police to have secondary employment, which no other city employee has the right to and typically does not have the right to. So not only do they carry out these aggressive actions against the people, but they're rewarded for it. and there's profit to be made, you know, by supplying this training, supplying the weapons, supplying the uniforms, not to mention the property that's seized of people. You know, I mean, I've heard even people who have been accused of crimes talk about being robbed by the police and law enforcement agencies, where they actually take drug money, take jewelry, even take drugs, and resell them, you know, within the drug market itself. So, yes, the ruling class, the capitalists in the United States, benefit from the drug trade. They benefit from crime. They encourage crime. Even in Afghanistan, you know, right now the poppy farming industry is flourishing right there under the nose of U.S. occupation and NATO occupation. We're talking about 100,000 U.S. NATO troops in that country, and they're exporting more poppies that are used for heroin production than they ever have. So how does that happen? How can you? It's the same thing in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War, how the heroin epidemic accelerated and it coincided with the Vietnam War, and heroin addiction worsened, and it became a social ill in black communities all across the United States. Right. So, yes, they do profit from crime. They profit from interpersonal violence, and they profit under the guise of cracking down on crime and interpersonal violence among the oppressed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you made some other points. You referred to the global scale of this in terms of foreign policy and so forth. Could you talk just a little bit about how you see the connection between what's happened in Detroit and in terms of the domestic situation with the militarization of our police, and what we're witnessing, the still unfolding drama or tragedy, more accurately, in just off the coast of Florida, in Haiti, post-earthquake Haiti, the militarization of the so-called relief effort. For the Haitian people, what kind of connection are we seeing there in terms of how that relief effort has been militarized?
Well, yes, they sent in thousands of U.S. military troops. The United Nations was already there for a number of years. They came after the U.S., France, and Canada overthrew the former government of John Bertrand Aristide. His government was supported by the poor and the working people in Haiti. It was overthrown, and the U.S. military came in and occupied the country and forced Aristide into exile. And this wasn't the first time that there was an occupation of Haiti. There was one in 1994, going back even to 1934 when they withdrew from Haiti, but in 1915, there was an invasion and occupation of Haiti for 19 years. Many people were killed in that process. Going all the way back, again, to the 1790s, at the beginning of the Haitian Revolution, the United States government, even in its infancy, opposed the Haitian Revolution. Even with the consolidation of the revolution in Haiti in 1803 and independence in 1804, the U.S. government, as well as France, would not even recognize Haiti for many, many years. The French forced the Haitians to pay indemnity for the property that was destroyed, the French owned property that had been stolen from the native peoples and the African peoples who were enslaved there. They were forced to pay for many, many years indemnity. And that was a condition for recognition by France of the independent Black Republic in Haiti. And then, of course, the United States didn't recognize Haiti until the Civil War in 1862. And, of course, the slave rebellion in Haiti and the independence of Haiti coincided with rebellions in this country. For example, Gabriel, who had organized a revolt, attempted to organize a revolt in Richmond, Virginia in 1800, in all likelihood was influenced by the Haitian Revolution. Mm-hmm. There were others. Nat Turner in 1831 in right. Southampton County organized a revolt in that part of Virginia. Then, of course, John Brown's raid and Oscar Anderson's raid on Harper's Ferry in 1859, which is really the first battle of the U.S. Civil War to end slavery. So the Haitian Revolution and the struggles against slavery in this country are interconnected, and other revolts that took place in the Caribbean as well as South America. You know, in Brazil, there were slave revolts and independent African communities established. Other parts today, what's known as the French Caribbean, we had similar efforts in St. John. Also in the Caribbean, there were slave revolts and independent African communities that were set up during that same time period. So, yes, the suppression of the Haitians' independence and sovereignty is a part of the racist foreign policy of the United States. It's interesting that even in the aftermath of the earthquake, they're still enforcing the blockade. The Coast Guard are still not allowing Haitians to enter the United States. They only lifted the deportation order against tens of thousands of Haitians temporarily. It's not a permanent lifting. So I think some of the demands we need to raise is to point out the double standard and the racist character of U.S. immigration policy, that all Haitians who are in the United States now should be allowed to become legalized citizens of the United States, at least permanent residents of the United States. It's been done for other countries, other nations. I mean, look at Cuba. Now, because they want to undermine the revolutionary government of former President Fidel Castro and current President Raul Castro, most Cubans, or many Cubans who come from the island to the United States, are immediately put in a legalization program. That's because they want to use those people against the Cuban Revolution. But in regard to Haiti, they have a totally different foreign policy. They do not want any Haitians in the United States to have any type of permanent residence or citizenship. So this is clearly a double standard. And we've seen immigration policy historically in the United States to be very racist. They had quotas to allow Germans, Italians, Irish people, people from various parts of Europe to come into the United States. But they've always limited immigration from countries where the majority of the population are of African descent, in the Caribbean, in Latin America, as well as on the African continent. So, and that is specifically designed to keep America as a white man's country.
Right.
And a lot of the domestic repression that we see right now is geared in that same direction. The incarceration of over a million African Americans and Latinos in the United States, the massive unemployment among African Americans and Latinos, among youth in this country, is clearly designed to undermine the social stability and social fabric of those communities. Now, it's interesting that this year, 2010, the majority of babies that are going to be born in the United States are babies of color.
Hmm.
And so the handwriting is on the wall that in a matter of a generation or two, the United States could very well be a majority people of color country. And this is what's feared by the ruling class in this country, by the racists. And that's why you have these neo-fascist movements that are coming up. That's why you have this repressive domestic and foreign policy that's being enacted by both the Democratic and the Republican parties. It's
right.
Not just the Republican Party that's behind a lot of these policies and programs. The Democrats are just as much guilty of these racist immigration policies, the repressive and apparatus of the federal government, the local governments, the racist and imperialistic foreign policy of the United States. Obama is there in the White House now, and the war in Afghanistan has escalated. The spending for the Africa Command on the African continent has accelerated. The funding of Homeland Security has not been cut. The Patriot Act has not been repealed. The Military Commissions Act has not been repealed. So we have the same repressive state apparatus taking place, whether it's under a right-wing Republican administration or more moderate Democratic administration. So people have to really understand that this is a systematic problem, and it's not going to be solved by electing somebody into office. But it's got to be solved by the people themselves.
Right. And Brother Abayomi, could you bring us up to speed with any current developments surrounding the FBI murdering of Imam Luqman Abdullah. And if you could, you know, kind of give the listeners a background of what actually happened, because I'm sure if most listeners are loyal, you know, listeners or viewers of the corporate media, they probably have no idea who this man is and how he was murdered by the FBI.
Yes, well, Imam Luqman Amin Abdullah was a resident of the city of Detroit. He was 53 years old. He had worked for years as a Muslim leader in the African-American community, doing charitable work, working with youth, working with homeless people, reforming criminals, people who are considered juvenile delinquents. And for this, he was rewarded with 20 bullets by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He was set up by the FBI. The FBI put informants in his organization over a period of 5 years. They sought to encourage him and other members of his organization to engage in criminal acts. Even the whole scenario that was set up when he was killed was orchestrated by the FBI. They were told, him and a number of his followers were told that they were needed in Dearborn, which is a neighboring suburb, to come out and assist in unloading some merchandise from a truck into a warehouse, and they would be paid $300 for doing this. So they went out there, and lo and behold, the truck, the warehouse, and all this had been set up by the FBI. They sent an attack dog. They set off a flash grenade, then they sent an attack dog in, which immediately went to him and attacked him. We have the autopsy photographs. He has numerous deep lacerations on his face and his hands from dog bites. They claim that he drew a weapon and killed the dog. We don't know if that's the truth or not, because they never released a necropsy report on the dog who supposedly died in the conflict. Then the FBI opened fire on him, shooting him 20 times with 21 actual wounds on his person. Many of the wounds were below the waist level, in the groin area. So this is the type of torture and execution that the federal government is being involved in right now. Then, of course, the FBI issued a 44-page criminal complaint against Imam Luqman and his followers. It was 10 of them who have been charged with felony counts involving trafficking and stolen goods and racketeering and so forth. They did all of this based upon information supplied by their own informants, who they had put inside the Masjid al-Haq. Now, at the same time that this raid was taking place that resulted in the assassination of Imam Luqman Amin Abdullah, they also raided the Masjid al-Haq on the west side of Detroit. When people were inside praying, they walked in with guns and tried to intimidate the people there at the mosque. So then, of course, they've attempted to lie, to criminalize Imam Luqman and his followers, to say that they were terrorists, that they were Sunni Muslims who wanted to create a separate Islamic state in the United States. Well, so what if he did? Under the U.S. Constitution, free speech is supposed to be protected. But I guess it's not protected for people who they consider a threat, or they can frame as being a threat and they can exploit. Now, in assassinating Imam Luqman, they do two things. They intimidate the Muslim community in the United States, which has already been terrorized since 9/11. And in intimidating the Muslim community in the United States, they can justify the aggressive militaristic foreign policy towards Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and Somalia, as well as Yemen. Then another thing they do, since Imam was Luqman was African American and was known widely in the African American community as a Muslim leader, as a community leader, they also attempt to intimidate and terrorize the African-American community. So this is what they were attempting to do. And then, of course, in the aftermath, that make it appear as if Imam Lupin was this dangerous threat, and that there's a real a serious problem of a homegrown Islamic terrorism in the United States. All of this is nothing but a fabrication to justify repressive actions, the large-scale expenditures of Homeland Security, the large-scale expenditures of U.S. Military, the U.S. military apparatus, which is engaged in many operations around the world. And they have refused. The Muslim community, the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War and Injustice, the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality, many other organizations have come out and condemned this assassination of Imam Lupin. They have demanded an independent review of the evidence, that the FBI be held accountable for this crime that was committed against this African-American leader, a well-known leader here in the city of Detroit and around the country. And the FBI and the Justice Department and the U.S. Attorney, Eric Holder, has done absolutely nothing. Even John Conyers, who's a Detroit congressman, who's dean of the Congressional Black Caucus, who's the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, asked back in February for a review by the Justice Department, wrote a personal letter to Eric Holder asking for his involvement in this situation. And nothing has been done to address this. They suppressed the autopsy report for 3 months. It wasn't released because they claimed that there was some classified information that could not be released, which was a total fabrication as well. They suppressed the autopsy photographs as well for even a longer period of time. And just recently, they have released some information to the Michigan State Police, who are supposed to be also doing an investigation. Now, interestingly enough, the Michigan Attorney General, Mike Cox, the investigation into the death of young Ayanna Stanley Jones has been turned over to him as well, to the Michigan State Police, who went over to the home last week and essentially did a second raid on the house because when the state police showed up, this was like 3 or 4 days after the killing of Ayanna Jones, before Ayanna Jones was eulogized and buried on Saturday. The state police showed up over there wanting to do another search of the house. And when they would not cooperate, the family, they went and got a warrant and a locksmith and went ahead and staged another raid on the house. And then, of course, Mike Cox openly attacked the Reverend Al Sharpton, who came into town to eulogize Ayanna Stanley Jones, attacked him and saying that he had no business coming to Detroit in the aftermath of this killing, to even preach a funeral. You know, so this goes to show the level of intimidation and the level of racism that's being carried out here in the city of Detroit. So, yes, the people are outraged about the assassination of Imam Lupin Amin Abdullah. They're outraged about the assassination and murder of Ayanna Stanley Jones, the intensification of police repression. But the federal government, even under the Obama administration, has not taken on the Justice Department. They have not taken on the FBI. They have not taken on these local police forces, these prosecutors who are falsely arresting and using tainted DNA evidence and other forms of frame-up to put, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of African Americans in prison in this country. And there's no voice within the federal government itself that's moving to do anything about this. And then, of course, the Wayne County prosecutor here in Detroit has not said a word about the murder of Imam Lupin, has not staged any investigation, has refused to stage an investigation, saying that the information is classified and she doesn't have access to it. The murder of Ayanna Stanley Jones, the Wayne County prosecutor has not said a word about that, and the investigation has been turned over to the Michigan State Police. So this is totally bogus. The Michigan State Police is just another branch of law enforcement. They are not going to conduct an objective, penetrating analysis and investigation into this crime because they themselves are involved in the crime. The state police just Friday night in Detroit engaged in a high-speed chase through the same neighborhood that Ayanna Jones was killed in, resulting in a crash. And then when one of the people got out of the car after the crash, they were shot by a state police officer. And people were so outraged, they came out into the streets, and they had to send some ministers over there in that community to try to calm down the people because they were afraid that there may be some type of civil unrest here in the city of Detroit in response to these escalating acts of repression against the people. So they haven't done anything about Imam Lukman. They're trying to cover up his assassination and trying to criminalize him. They have not done anything about the murder of Ayanna Stanley Jones. They're trying to criminalize the family. They're trying to cover it up. They're trying to whitewash it. Then they're trying to channel everybody off into some direction of fighting crime. Well, you can't fight crime in a capitalist society unless you provide jobs, housing, health care, pensions, and quality education for people. That's the only way crime is going to go down in this country, and that's what we got to stand up and give voice to. We got to stand up and say, no, you're not going to criminalize our people. You're not going to criminalize a whole generation of youth in this country and neglect your responsibility as a federal government, as a corporate community, to provide what people need. Now, we know that can't be done under this system. So it raises the level of consciousness among the people.
Right.
In my opinion, this government, this system, is incapable of providing jobs to the people. They're incapable of providing real security to people, and as a result of that, people have to take action on their own.
Right, and that brings me to I can't believe, man. Like they said, that, you know, time flies when you're getting good information, man. You've really like provided us with a wealth of valuable information, and the way I want to close the show, I wanted to ask you with this one last question that's a segue to what you were just talking about. How can myself, Peter, and the Your World News listeners, how can we mobilize to really put a stop to this? And I want the listeners to make sure that I've put a link to it on our webpage, but make sure that you visit www.panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. But Abiyomi, how do we, I mean, you've been doing this for a long time in terms of community organizing and activism and mobilizing communities and people together. How do we start, you know what I'm saying, right now to, you know, towards like putting this wheel towards ending this repressive, fascist, racist machine that is consuming black and brown skin lives as we speak?
Well, the first thing we need to do is to speak truth to power. We have to denounce, you know, any act of repression by the police, by the corporate community, by the federal government against the people. And we have to call it for what it is. Then we cannot allow the ruling class, the corporate media, and these puppet politicians to deflect our attention away from what the real enemy is and what the real problem is. The real problem is that there's a extreme economic crisis here in the United States, and to address that crisis, they're attempting to criminalize and victimize particularly the oppressed people in this country, the African Americans, the Latinos, and other people of color, to criminalize that segment of the population and to enrich those in the corporate community, in the banking community, and those within the security and intelligence apparatus of the country. So we have to speak truth to power. Then, of course, we have to organize and mobilize the people. You know, in any area where there's a coalition, anti-police brutality coalition, or any type of progressive coalition, these type of incidents should be on the top of the agenda to address, to both mobilize the people to ensure that these incidents do not happen, and also to create a situation where the police feel that they cannot, with impunity, carry out acts of violence and criminality against African and other people of color in this country. Then, of course, we have to link up on a national level. The various groups that are fighting police misconduct and police brutality need to hook up on a national level and carry out coordinated political activity. We need to collaborate. We need to exchange information. We need to also hook up with prison groups that are doing support work around prisons, because it's a whole chain of events. You have racial profiling. This is the initial intake, you know, where African Americans are pulled over, principally youth. And anything they can arrest them on or ticket them on, this is done. Then, of course, they go into the racist courts who are prejudiced against African Americans. Then after they go through the courts, they go into the jails and into the prisons. So this is a vicious, attempted permanent incarceration and suppression of whole layers of population groups in this country. So we have to hook up with people who are doing legal work, who are working against police brutality, who are working around prisons, and also the whole anti-war and peace movement has to be brought into this as well, because the foreign policy arm of all of this are the wars that are nonstop, the so-called permanent wars, where, as you mentioned earlier, people don't even question whether or not the U.S. military should be in Afghanistan or Iraq or in Pakistan or in Somalia or have a blockade against Cuba or have a hostile policy towards Venezuela and create havoc by opening up military bases in Colombia to finance, you know, repressive fascist government that exists in Colombia and some of these other right-wing countries throughout the world. So all of these issues are related, but we got to work in our communities, we got to work in our schools, we got to work in our churches and our mosques to organize, to mobilize, and to get this information out. And I think this radio show is an excellent mechanism that's been used for some time now to get this information out. So those are a few of the things that we have to do.
Thank you so much, Brother Ezekwe. I really appreciate you coming on, and thanks for being a continued correspondent for Your World News, and most of all, thank you for your commitment and dedication and the work that you've done on behalf of the Pan-African community and poor and oppressed people throughout. We look forward to having you on again, and on behalf of Peter, I just want to thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the great work that both of you are doing.
All right. Take care, brother. And we will see you, next time on Your World News.
Thank you so much.
Me, I would never make it, I would never achieve it. Reality is nourishment, but people don't believe it. I guess it's hard to stomach the truth like a bulimic. It's a dirty game and nobody is willing to clean it. But this is for the paraplegic people dreaming and running. Ladies married to men who don't please them, dreaming of coming. Verbally murderous like David Berkowitz when I'm gunning. Some cowards on the internet didn't think I would sell. Scared to talk shit in person cause they stuck in a shell and couldn't understand the pain of being stuck in a cell. Hell is not a place you go if you're not a Christian. It's the failure of your life's greatest ambition. It's a bad decision to blindly follow any religion. I don't see the difference in between the wrong and the wrong. Soldiers emptying the clips at little kids and their moms are just like a desperate motherfucker strapped to a bomb. Humanity's gone, smoked up in a gravity bong by a Democrat, Republican, Cheech and Chong. Immortal technique, you never heard me preach in a song. I'm not controversial, I'm just speaking the facts. Put your hands in the air like you got the heat to your back and shake your body like a baby born addicted to crack. And since life's a gamble like the crap tables at Vegas, I freestyle my destiny, it's not written in pages. Tell us how far we came to be, as if our people's history started with slavery. Painfully I discovered the shit they kept a secret. This is the exodus, like the black Jews out of Egypt. I keep it reality based with the music I make. Blow up the truth in your face with the style I run with, like the Navy missile that shot down Flight 800. I'm like the Africans who came here before Columbus, and from the 1500s until after tomorrow. I watch Latin America get raped in the sorrow. You see, the Spaniards never left después de Colón. And if you don't believe me, you can click on Univision young. I never seen so much racism in all of my life. Every program and newscast, all of them white. It's like apartheid with 10% ruling the rest. That type of stress will make you put the fucking tool in your chest. Step in my way, nigga, I wouldn't wanna be ya. I burn slow like pissing drunk with gonorrhea. I'll do a free show in North Korea burning the flag, while J. Edgar Hoover politicians dress up in drag, trying to confuse you, making it hard to follow this. Capitalism and democracy are not synonymous. Swallow propaganda like a birth control pill, selling your soul to the eye on the back of the dollar bill. But that'll never be me, cause I'm leaving the past like an abused wife with the kids, leaving your ass like a drug addict, clean and sober, leaving the stash. Unbreakable technique, leaving a plane crash. I'm out with the black box and I refuse to return. I spit reality instead of what you usually learn, and I refuse to be concerned with condescending advice, cause I'm the only motherfucker that could change my life. I won't make it, but I know that I will escape the emptiness, cause that shit is slow when it kills the flow and the skill. I made y'all believe it at last. You can make the future, but it starts believing the past.